Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Charles Baxter, who's author of The Sun Collector, to be published on November 17th by Pantheon. I think this is Charles' sixth novel, a very prolific career, dating back to First Light, all the way back in 1987, and including The Feast of Love in 2000, which was made into a movie you might remember starring Morgan Freeman and good old Fred Ward. he's also published numerous story collections as well as nonfiction, poetry, and editing as well. So, The Sun Collective, our protagonist, who we see through the eyes of a third-person omniscient fellow, is retired from designing bridges. His name is Harold Bredigan, and he has a close and bantering relationship with his lovely wife of decades, Alma. But things kind of start to go a little screwy, and we are joined by a president who seems oddly familiar, as well as a cast of queer, in the old sense of the word, figures who meander about the margins of our senses and then appear closer as we begin to discern a kind of method to the madness that begins to descend on them and us. So Charles, in addition to thanking you, here we are in as strange a world as you paint, but it's also almost like saying, hey Charles, you wrote a book about current events.
Well, it wasn't my intention when I started this book to write a novel that was going to be, air quotes here, relevant to contemporary political reality. But, if you work on a novel for 5 years, it's hard for what's going on not to filter in and to make itself felt. What really got the novel started was the simple fact that I live here in downtown Minneapolis, and every day I go for walks, and if you live in a major American city, you're going to see homeless people. And I got to know some of them, I talked to a number of them. I see them with some regularity, and I gradually began to think of a story in which people are tormented in some sense by the question of what should I be doing as an individual? What should I do about the people whom I see? I mean, and in some sense, that's both a religious question, it's a spiritual question, and it's a political question. So, I mean, those were some of the elements that got it started.
Well, what's funny about it to a reader is it's like, especially if you started it 5 years ago, is the world kind of caught up to your novel.
And, yes, yes.
And,
go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, you deal with a president who's very similar to our president in many ways. And the interesting thing was Prometheus Unchained, by the author who's cloaked Ayn Rand, Sally Ann Shirley. And there's actually a rationalist society like the Federalist Society that adheres to her beliefs like Paul Ryan used to do. Mm-hmm. And where did that come about from, this virtue of selfishness, this idea that you don't want to help other people because you don't want to give them a leg up, they need to do it on their own?
You know, if you're thinking of putting together a story, if you're thinking of putting together something as large as a novel, you need, I won't say that you need a villain, but you need a certain point of negative energy, something that pushes against the main part of the novel. And since the main part of the novel has to do with a group of people who are thinking about charity and thinking about good works and what they want to do for the disadvantaged, I just naturally began to think of, well, what stands against that? And In an earlier version of the novel, I just had named Ayn Rand. I named Atlas Shrugged and John Galt. And then I thought, no, I want to stylize this a bit. So she turned into Sally Ann Shirley, but it's still there. it's still there. And, you know, the thinking of Ayn Rand in some sense goes back to American writers like Ralph Waldo Emerson. There's a long pedigree in American literature of people who are advocating self-reliance and who are in some sense opposed to charity. So I had a lot to go on.
But it's funny though, because, you know, there you fictionalized her to a certain extent, but then your buddy, Sherwood Anderson, there he is. And then, you know, then you have Timothy in Our Town, The Glass Menagerie, As You Like It, Antigone, and The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, which also seems quite relevant today.
Right.
So you chose a lot of real things to mm-hmm. put in there. And I was actually going to ask you, how did you choose the plays for Timothy? Did they just come into your head or?
Well, the first plays I thought of were plays particularly by Chekhov. Uncle Vanya was the first one I thought that Timothy would have been in. But as I began to work on the novel, I thought that, and again, this goes back to the fact that I was writing this novel during the Trump years, that if there had ever been a playwright who had thought about politics and the rise of gangsterism in politics, it was Brecht. So sure, it was logical for me to put in The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy and to have Timothy, my character, be the central play.
There was actually an article in the New York Times today carefully comparing Trump to Mussolini, which I've been doing for the past 4 years.
Really? Was that was in the paper today? I have to look it up.
Yeah, it's really good. It was a comparison to other kind of narcissistic despots as well. And then contrast how he didn't accomplish the goals that normally a narcissist accomplished during his tenure.
Right, right.
Switching, there are certain sentences in your books that shouldn't be pivotal at all. But then to the reader, at least this one, they are. And one that I picked out, and then I guess in order to sell your book, I need to ask you about the book. I always forget that. Is the sentence that discusses, why do you pick up a wine bottle and find it exterior moisture excessive? Now, to me, okay, that doesn't really mean anything. But then it does, and I have no idea why or how you do that.
I probably would, I ought to be able to give you an authoritative answer for your question. And
not necessarily.
All I can say is that for me, ideally, when I'm fiction, I try to make my mind and my imagination as open, and I think maybe the adjective is as porous as possible, so that any idea that I have that comes to me may well end up in the novel. I hope it doesn't shock you or your listeners or your viewers when I say I have absolutely no memory of having written that sentence.
So I'm telling you, and you, does it remind you of the sentence? I
yes.
can understand if it doesn't, but yeah. The thing about it is, it's almost like, okay, this world is too much with him. You know what I mean? It's like,
yes,
it's
yes.
just like there's so much coming mm-hmm. in, like Sartre's nausea. You know, it's like,
right.
there's just too much stuff.
Too much stuff, right.
Yeah, and then the other thing is, because I'm an independent bookseller, And I say this all the time, but as many people as tell us that you can't judge a book by its cover, everyone who comes into my bookstore judges every book by its cover. And it's a great cover. It has this idea that, you know, whether you're interested in science fiction or fantasy or something out of the realm of the ordinary, it's a great cover. So I was wondering whether you got a chance to vet it, whether they gave you, you know, a bunch of different covers you could have looked at.
I did have a chance to vet it. And the cover was almost entirely the work of my editor, Dan Frank, at Pantheon. And Dan had been thinking about what was in the novel, and he had seen a Renaissance painting, and I'll have to ask him which one it was, in which there is a halo around the sun. And he got it into his head that that would be some version of that would be an ideal cover for this book, because the cover as it stands is in fact somewhere between realism and fantasy.
Right.
And it also has a kind of, I think, a religious overtone, which to some degree the events of the novel have as well. So I was delighted by the cover that they came up with.
Yeah, and it's going to do really well on the front table of our store, because I just watch people come in and go, oh, that's a nice cover, that's a nice guy. And then my daughter, who's a really good hand seller, she comes out from behind and goes, you have to buy this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other thing as a bookseller I'm interested in, because this is the second thing that people do, is they look at the epigraph. And the epigraph is something I always think, well, it either came at the beginning or you thought very carefully about it. And this one is an excerpt from a poem by Lewis Simpson. And it's kind of unpleasant in a way. And the entire poem itself is unpleasant, but in a very good and intelligent way. So yeah. Indulge me, I'll read it. It's complicated being an American, having the money and the bad conscience, both at the same time. Perhaps after all, this is not the right subject for a poem. Mm-hmm. And that wraps the book up and again, where we are right now. So How did you come up with it? And I know you're a poet as well.
Yeah, I had always loved Louis Simpson's poetry, and I can recite long passages of it. But this particular poem, On the Lawn at the Villa, has a kind of plot. Louis Simpson was a soldier in the Second World War. He was in the infantry, but he was also one of those guys who runs along the front line passing information. And immediately after the war, maybe in the closing days of the war, he found himself at a villa in Italy, and he had been invited for drinks and cocktails, and there were dead people, dead soldiers hanging down. I don't know if you have the poem there.
Yeah.
Hanging down from the top of the villa. And so he's sitting there having drinks, looking at the dead. And then the poem says, it's difficult being an American, having the money and the bad conscience both at the same time. Perhaps after all, this is not the right subject for a poem. In another poem in from that same period, he says of America, grave by grave, we civilize the ground. A wonderful poet. He's not much read anymore, but I had those lines had stuck in my head for years, and I thought, by God, I'm going to put them at the front of my novel.
It's funny because the interview I'm doing right after this one is by a guy named Jacob Goldstein, who works for NPR. And his book is called Money, The True Story of a Made-Up Thing.
it's a great title.
Yeah, it's this mass fiction that doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll let you go. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, in essence, it has four major characters, two older characters, Harry Bredigan and his wife, Alma, and two younger ones, a guy who says his name is Ludlow, and a woman, a young woman who eventually becomes his sort of girlfriend, Christina. And the acute event of the novel that in some sense gets things going is that Harry and Alma have a son named Timothy, who is an actor and who has had a breakdown of some sort and seems to be living on the street in Minneapolis, where all this takes place, so that the homeless people whom they see have taken on a kind of personal investment for them. And they gradually become involved with a social organization called the Sun Collective, which begins as a kind of neighborhood organization with a free store and garden plots. And they're thinking of starting a bank and so on. And Harry and Alma come to meet Christina and Ludlow through the Sun Collective. And it's also through the Sun Collective that they meet up again with their son. But there would be no novel if there weren't some real trouble brewing, and there is in the Sun Collective. It begins to seem a very benevolent, and for the most part is a benevolent organization, but Ludlow is not quite what he seems, and he's the ambassador of big trouble into the novel.
And what's really interesting is you have the man in the trilby hat. And it's not really a spoiler because the reader has to guess, and there's nothing I can say about him that tells you who he is. But with the glasses that not are foggy, but are somehow opaque, but not. And then you have this gentleman named Y, who kind of runs the Sun Collective. And then the reader has to decide, well, I don't know. Yeah. And the gentleman in the trilby hat is kind of a, for sake of a better word, like a seer or a fortune teller or a doctor. Yeah. Whatever he's a doctor of. What was he a doctor of again? Psycho?
Proton analytics. He's a doctor of proton analytics. I had a lot of fun making that up.
Yeah, I can imagine.
The doctor and why, along with other elements in the novel, are meant to convey to the reader that the book you're reading is partly based in realism, but some of it isn't. It's a kind of wonderland.
Yeah, like a lot of your books.
Yeah, this one more, I think, than any of the others, except maybe The Soul Thief. But this one really is a wonderland. And
you do have a woman who makes up her own language.
Right. That's true. You remember that. That's in Shadow Play. and in this one, the effect of the wonderland is intensified by a drug that Christina has gotten a hold of called Blue Telephone, which messes up your sense of space-time. The truth is that I thought and I still think that having lived through the last 4 years, we have all been in a kind of wonderland, and that the techniques of straight realism wouldn't work. You can't write like Edith Wharton and give a sense that way of what it's been like for the last 4 years, what it is like to be alive now. I really felt I needed to goose the prose, goose the style, so that sometimes you felt as if you were in the real world and sometimes you weren't sure.
Exactly, which is what I love. And the thing about it is it's much harder now for authors to write this kind of book, because for the past 4 years, my friend Mike and I, who works in my bookstore, great guy, we keep saying, we started out by saying, you couldn't make this stuff up. But then each day, it's more and more. And now it seems stupid to say you can't make this stuff up, because you can't even make the stuff up that you couldn't make up before. Yeah. So it's how can Saturday Night Live satirize Trump? It's impossible.
Right. Right, exactly. You know, Philip Roth said that reality had outstripped fiction, and that fiction might not be adequate to what is happening to reality, to current events. And, you know, he has a point, but I think if you're a novelist, really your earthly job is to convey to readers what it feels like to be alive at a certain time. And I that's what I was trying to do as I was working on this book, trying to give a sense of what it feels like, or what it felt like to be alive now, with everything that is kind of descending on us.
The other, me and my non sequitur fashion, the other one is, the other two characters are Woland and Behemoth. So you have a dog and a cat, and it reminded me, eventually Alma's able to talk to him, but you have a dog and a cat, and it reminded me of a New Yorker cartoon where the dog is sitting by the front door and his master is late and he comes in and the dog goes, "Where were you? I was worried about you."
Yeah.
Whereas the cat's going, "Where's my food?"
Right. Woland and Behemoth were my importations from this novel, The Master and Margarita, by Mikhail Bulgakov. Absolutely one of my favorite novels all my life. I have loved this book. And in The Master and Margarita, there's a talking cat who's a dead shot with a Browning automatic. And the cat is Behemoth. And so I just imported them. The dog very nearly had the last word in the novel. In the previous version, the next to last chapter, in fact, was the last chapter. And Alma is talking to the dog and the cat. And the dog ends that chapter by saying, she doesn't know what's happened to her husband. And the dog says, "Oh, he'll come back. He always comes back." And she says, "Why do you say that?" And the dog says, "Love and loyalty. What else is there?"
And the cat says, "Why are you asking me? I don't.
Why are you asking me? Ask the dog. That's the dog's department." But my editor thought, and I think correctly, that had to be the next to last chapter. And what is, in fact, in the last chapter bookends the novel, because Harry is back on the light rail. And what the doctor promised him would happen eventually happens in the last chapter.
Which would be a spoiler.
Which would be a spoiler. Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, there's so much of your hometown in this, starting with, I guess, with the bridge that Harold wishes he hadn't designed. I mean, he's glad he hasn't
designed. Glad he didn't design.
And it's a true story. I mean, tell that story. That's a good one.
Well, actually, the It's not the I-35 bridge which collapsed in Minneapolis. The bridge that he's glad he didn't design was the Martin Szabo pedestrian bridge, which had cable stays that snapped. And I had once thought that along with everything else that I wanted to put into the novel, I wanted to have some element of deterioration of American infrastructures. But I just couldn't work it. I couldn't work it in. But the remnant of that is that Harry is a bridge designer, as is my son. So whenever I needed any details about bridge design, I just went to Daniel, and he filled me in on it. But I wanted a kind of grounding for the novel, and anybody who has lived or visited the Twin Cities will probably recognize some elements of Minneapolis-St. Paul that I've put into the book.
Yeah. The reference was very close to the Szabo Bridge was the movie Outward Bound, which I watched again after reading the book. And it's interesting you put that in because basically it's kind of like a no exit kind of thing,
right,
where you
right.
have these characters that, well, this is not giving anything away. You have these characters that are dead on the train. They don't know they're dead at first. And then they realize they're on this train going to wherever you may go. And I was trying to figure out exactly, I mean, I do see it, but exactly how you came up, you mean, because some of these references are somewhat obscure, and how you came up with that as a vehicle to inform the reader that maybe this is where we're going as well.
I guess there were two things that went into that. The first was that I have ridden the subway in New York. I've been on a lot of Amtrak trains. I've ridden the light rail here in Minneapolis. And if you ride these things often, you see people who look comatose. People fall asleep on trains. They fall asleep in the New York subway. And something clicked, and I remembered a movie that I had seen, I think when I was in middle school or high school. And I remembered it as being a black and white film with very rudimentary sound. And I remembered that it had been called Outward Bound. And it was about these people who were on an ocean liner, and they had no idea how they had gotten on it or where they were going. And, you know, the process of writing fiction is often a process just of association. And I thought, oh, I'll just get Outward Bound into this book, and then I'll have to explain what it is. Because you may have seen Outward Bound, and I may have seen it, but 98% of the readers of this book probably haven't seen it and may not have heard of it. But as a metaphor, it's terrific. It's absolutely terrific, and it serves my thematic purposes in presenting the light rail in Minneapolis and what's going to happen to Harry Bredigan.
You know, you talk about what the reader, 98% of the readers might not get, but then you put in, and I'll butcher this, but Abends will ich schlafen gehen. And, you know, I guess that's from Hansel and Gretel, I think. Maybe not.
It's a nursery rhyme. It may have found its way into Hansel and Gretel, but I just found it as a German nursery rhyme. The equivalent in English is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, bless the bed that I lie on. Before I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. Four corners to my bed, four angels there are spread, two to feet and two to head, and two to carry me when I'm dead. The German is not exactly like that, but very close to it.
How come you put in, when I was reading, I was thinking, well, how does he know about Blue Telephone, and how does he know about something is going on and you don't know what it is, Mr. Jones. And I'm thinking, oh, we're kind of contemporary, so of course he knows what Blue Telephone is. Maybe he took it. I don't know.
But, I made it up. There is no such drug.
I know, but it has this kind of like quaalude kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, why would he know that? Or why would he know Bob Dylan songs? And I go, oh, he's kind of like my age, you know?
And, you put in what's available to you, and I knew this was going to be a fairly large novel. In the earlier drafts, it was at least 150 pages longer, and I was just emptying my pockets. Everything that I had was going into this book. You know, Bob Dylan, Outward Bound, all of this material. If I could find a place for it, I put it there.
Well, you have the luxury too of the fact that you are a short story writer, so you can always flip. You can always say, what am I going to do with this, right?
Right. The short story is such a wonderful form, but it's much more disciplined than the novel. You know, when you're writing short stories, you're just constantly throwing things out that won't fit. When you're writing a novel, I think the opposite is true. Everything that seems germane, you can put in because there's room for it. It's a very forgiving form. But the danger there is that you'll just keep putting things in that have no place. And you've got a as Henry James said, a loose baggy monster on your hands.
And then your editor says you have to cut out.
Got to take it out.
Must be horrible. But, you know, it's true. And I don't know why. I love short stories, but there's so many people who come into my bookstore and say, I hate short stories. And I think they're wonderful. And what you're saying is, I think, who was I just listening to? David Sedaris. Talking about, it's like a portmanteau, you know, you have to, or a poem, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it should not be mean, but be. Yeah. And, yeah, if you, when New Yorker was really good, you'd read these stories, and at the end, whether it was the lottery, a perfect, which actually has some elements of your book in it.
It does.
But I don't know where I was going with that.
The difference between the short story and the novel, and the fact that a lot of readers are not crazy about short stories. One of my friends years ago was complaining to me about reading short stories, and I asked her why, and she said, "Oh, reading a short story is too much like a one-night stand." It seems like a frivolous criticism, but in fact, what she was saying was that she likes the extended feeling of living with characters, maybe for day after day after day that you're reading a longer book. I mean, when you're reading Anna Karenina, you're really getting to know Anna and her husband and Vronsky and Levin and Kitty. There are all of these people, and you're living with them day after day. There's a real pleasure in that.
I agree. Except, you know, with me and maybe with you, I read it in one sitting. I can't help it, which is very irritating because you're keeping me up until 4 o'clock in the morning, which screws up my whole next day.
Yeah.
But I can just see myself sitting in the chair by my other library, and it's just, I can't, my partner's saying, when are you coming to bed? When are you coming to bed?
Right.
You know. Right. You know who my favorite character in the book is?
I'm tempted to ask or to say Jürgen.
Yeah.
I'm glad. I'm very glad. I'm glad to hear that.
And it's so funny because Jürgen is one of my favorite novels by James Branch Cabell. And your work is similar to his in many ways. And Neil Gaiman attributes a lot of his work to him. Sandman, he attributes Sandman, and then you have the Sandman too. So I'm thinking, oh, this is kind of weird. Yeah. And it's interesting because he looks at things, Jürgen and the Jürgen and James Branch Cable, he looks at things from the outside. Yes. He's the only person there that can look America from outside, and he's disappointed. Mm-hmm. He's disappointed in what he sees, and he's explaining to Christina that something wicked this way comes.
That's right.
And but then the question he asks, is Trump a mesmerist? Mm-hmm. Which goes to that article today in the Times.
Is
Trump a mesmerist, like the president in your book? It's a crazy question.
It's a great question. And I wouldn't really presume to have an answer for it, because if he's a mesmerist, if he's put people under a spell, I can only speak to that from the outside, because he never put me under a spell. But there are 71 million voters who I think did fall under his spell, despite everything they may have known about his character. I loved Jürgen. Actually, my second novel, Shadow Play, was translated into German as Schattenspiel by this wonderful guy, Jürgen Dierken, who died during the time I was working on this book. And Jürgen, the bank manager in my novel, is my small tribute to my friend Jürgen Dierken. They dress in the same way. They say some of the same things. I remember some of the things that Jürgen Dierken said to me, and I put them in the novel. I also attributed to him some things that I never heard my friend Jürgen say, but you're exactly right. They were both outsiders to our culture and could comment on it. I think it was Jürgen who said to me that his grandmother had referred to Hitler as a mesmerist. And he was very unhappy about that.
Yeah, I know. I asked my brother, why is this happening? And he always goes, Sam, it's because 50% of Americans feel this way and 50% of Americans feel this way. That's why elections are close.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, in the past 4 years, I've interviewed maybe 200 authors, and there's not one single Trump supporter. And I was wondering why. And then I realized, because they're intelligent.
Yeah.
And it's so strange. And then I assume you have good friends. Maybe you don't. But I have friends who are Trump supporters, and I really can't talk to them anymore.
Yeah. I have maybe two friends who are Trump supporters. And it's just not an acceptable subject of conversation.
I know.
There's just nothing to be said anymore.
And my problem is I end up being rude, and there's an avid Trump supporter in my nonfiction book club, and I'm not going to the nonfiction book club anymore because it's mean of me, and I'll end up saying something to her like, there's something wrong with you. There's something wrong in your brain, in your mind. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk like, I don't want to be forced to become like them.
Yeah.
Find myself hating people, and I don't want to live a life where I hate people.
Yeah. Well, you read some of the accounts of Weimar Germany and the kinds of small brush fires, these fights that were breaking out between the leftists and the National Socialists, the Nazis, the sense that in some sense conversation had broken down in that period. Fighting had come to replace conversation.
Yeah, it's like masks becoming a political statement or the end of civil discourse. Right. Problem is, it's like divorce. When one person wants to get divorced and the other person doesn't, they get divorced.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Tell the story about how Jürgen is upset when he comes to work that day because of the cars.
Oh, my friend Jürgen, I was driving him around Minneapolis, and we found ourselves at a stoplight, and there was a SUV in front of us, and he was in the passenger seat, and he said, "Well, what is that?" And I said, "Well, that's an SUV." He said, "I think they are kind of vulgar, don't you?" And I remember another German friend of mine who had taken me out on the Autobahn with my wife and my son. We were going about 120 miles an hour. And he said, "You have to be German to drive this fast." And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, "Because Americans lack lane discipline." And actually, my friend Jürgen was in the back seat, and I turned to him and said, "You must be used to going this fast." And Jürgen said, "I have never been so frightened in my life." But the idea of Americans lacking lane discipline stuck in my head. And every time I'm on the freeway and somebody passes me in the right-hand lane, I think, yeah, we don't have lane discipline.
I once deposed a scientist in Wiesbaden, Germany, and he was telling me on the Autobahn, he was saying, "You know, we designed our signage after American signage." And then I was looking at it. Their signage is perfect. It's intuitive, totally intuitive, whereas ours is generally totally counterintuitive.
That's right.
So I'm wondering if they took it from us, the big green sign, how did they perfect it?
Yeah. I have no idea.
The other auto incident would also be a spoiler, and it's a big pivotal part of the book.
Yeah.
And Christina is a very interesting character, because when she comes to dinner with them, or when they kind of assist Alma when she has her incident with the mirror in the stream, Christina seems aloof and, you know, like, as you said, sometimes just looking at things as if this is so boring. But she's not that at all.
No, she's not. She starts the novel as a kind of deconstructionist and skeptic. And as the novel goes on, I think she becomes heroic. But she has a bad conscience about what she's done. And she has a bad conscience about what's happened to Ludlow, without spoiling things. I hadn't foreseen that episode with the car would happen until about 2 weeks before I actually wrote the scene.
Wow.
And, you know, the funny thing about writing a novel is that everything that's in your conscious mind and your unconscious mind has a chance of ending up there. And what happens to Christina and Ludlow in that car more or less came to me as I was falling asleep one night. And the chapter in which it happens feels a bit like a dream, but it isn't. You know, it's what actually has happened.
It's very well planned out, but it does feel like a dream. Yes.
Yeah. And the sentences are different from the sentences in much of the rest of the book. The prose is written in that chapter as if you're going 80 or 90 miles an hour. It's not standard prose. It's just running down the page.
And there you go. Back. You said you can't write like Edith Wharton, and you did.
Well.
And that's not spoiling it, because no one knows what I'm talking about.
You're talking about Ethan Frome.
Yeah. Oh, you do.
Yeah, I do. And in fact, the reference to Ethan Frome is mistaken and has to be fixed for the paperback.
Yes, it does.
And it has to be fixed. And the person who pointed that out to me was Laurie Moore.
Really?
Yeah.
It's so funny, because I saw it and I go, I wonder why he's doing that.
Because I forgot. I forgot what actually happens.
Well, then I thought, did I forget what actually happened?
Because no, you didn't forget. No, I hadn't read that book since I read it in high school.
Yeah.
And I just got the details wrong.
It's so funny, because I didn't like the book, but that scene in the book will forever, no matter how long I live, stay with me.
It's unforgettable. Unforgettable.
The question about that scene is, why did he have to do it this way? There's so many other ways out. And then I thought, I've done that all my life.
Mm-hmm.
There's always an easier way. Yeah. And yet somehow I find, you know, it's like fear. Yeah. It's like if you're afraid to climb over a curb that's this high, you're not going to do it.
That's right.
Even if it's the easiest thing in the world to do.
Yeah. Because I mean, it's far from me to say what Edith Wharton was or was not thinking when she was writing Ethan Frome, but you remember that scene and I remember that scene.
Yes.
And maybe she thought, this is something they're not going to forget.
It's such a total tragedy in so many ways.
I know.
And then there's we're going to talk about it. But I will say this one thing, and I'll try and say it as neutrally as I can. Even though Christina did what happened, it was nice that you kind of let her off the hook. And I won't say what it was, but the official that comes to see her and pretends as if he concludes what he concludes, it's like going into a confessional.
Yes, yes, yes.
It was nice of you to do that.
Yeah, I couldn't let her off the hook, and she doesn't let herself off the hook either. Because after Detective Dennis O'Connor has talked to her, she has a moment when her remorse really just flows over her. But she's not guiltless, but she may well have done the right thing. I leave it to the reader to decide what to think about her.
Yeah, and I made my decision.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I guess to conclude, I would, you know, like if you go on Terry Gross, this is what she's going to ask. She would ask, well, are you going to have a sequel to this or that? But you can't have a sequel, because your sequel would imply that you had some knowledge about what's going to happen in our real world. 5 or 6 times a day, people say to me, what do you think is going to happen? And I say, I have no idea. I'm not like the Oracle of Delphi. I literally, sometimes you have an idea of what's going to happen. In this next 68 days, something's going to happen.
Something's going to happen, and none of us knows what that thing is.
It's happening.
On January 20th, I will breathe a big sigh of relief.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Well, good point.
See? You, anyway, I could go on for hours. It was such a good book. And,
Thank you.
It's good that you keep going. I mean, you and I, it's good that we keep going.
Yeah. I know. Thank you. Yes.
You're welcome. So thanks for writing it. And I hope to see you again when you do your next one.
Okay, good.
Hey, Charles.
Thank you. All right. So long.